May it please the court, I represent the petitioner, Abraham Estramera. Mr. Estramera seeks relief because he would not be serving life in prison, but for trial counsel's bad advice with respect to two favorable pleas. The district court's denial of Mr. Estramera's claim without an evidentiary hearing should be reversed by this court because counsel's performance was constitutionally deficient and prejudiced Mr. Estramera. I'd like to begin with the merits of Mr. Estramera's ineffective assistance of counsel claim. This court should reverse the district court's denial of Estramera's petition without an evidentiary hearing because the facts alleged, if true, entitle him to relief. Mr. Estramera's Sixth Amendment
right... Did his lawyer tell him what the difference in his likely sentence would be if he pleaded guilty versus if he didn't?
Your Honor, I don't believe there's anything in the record to suggest that counsel discuss what the difference in sentencing would be. Mr. Estramera's affidavit.
It's important, isn't it?
I'm sorry, the difference in sentencing?
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor, I would say that is an important component of pleading guilty and part of why Mr. Estramera would want to reach a favorable plea in his case.
Well, there's never been a... Am I correct? There's never been a hearing in which the lawyer was questioned about... What was there?
That is correct, Your Honor. The district court denied Mr. Estramera's petition without holding an evidentiary hearing on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
So we don't know whether the lawyer told him that there could be a significant difference in sentence if he pleaded guilty versus going to trial?
All we have at this point, Your Honor, is Mr. Estramera's unrefuted affidavit that the only discussion of the plea agreements he had with counsel was counsel's continued insistence that he would have to cooperate with the government in order to plead guilty. He specifically stated that his attorney did not go over any other terms of the plea agreement.
Okay. Counsel, is Estramera literate in English?
Your Honor, I have received letters from Mr. Estramera that I assume he wrote, but beyond that, I'm not sure.
Well, I ask that because it apparently is agreed between the parties that he had copies of the proposed plea agreements.
He did, in fact...
And he, therefore, could see exactly what it was that was required of him, what kind of cooperation was required of him.
Well, Your Honor, he did, in fact, have copies of the plea agreement, but the problem in this case is that the Supreme Court has held that a criminal defendant is entitled to the effective assistance of counsel with respect to their plea.
No. Effective assistance means two things, both deficient performance and prejudice. And like Judge Posner, I'm asking about the second component. Can one claim prejudice if you've got in your hands the full plea agreement and can see for yourself exactly what is required?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Estramera has demonstrated a better than negligible chance of prejudice in his case because his affidavit clearly states that it was counsel's continued insistence on this point that prevented him.
This is a different question. It has to do with the intelligibility of the plea agreement to a person, and specifically the provision about the cooperation.
Exactly. Might say he didn't understand what that meant.
What educational background does he have?
Your Honor, I'm not sure there's anything in the record.
He doesn't sound very articulate, but we don't know anything about his education.
Your Honor, I do believe that he received his GED while he was in prison, but beyond that, I don't know. So going into his case, he did not have even a high school diploma.
Yeah,
wouldn't that be germane? For a lawyer to just hand the client a 10-page plea agreement with a lot of legal stuff in it,
And I'm following, if you're dealing with Judge Posner's same concern, because the language says he will cooperate with the United States during the ancillary stages, so my guess is he had no idea what that meant, of any forfeiture proceedings to defeat the claim of a third party, okay, wondering what that is, in the event a third party files a claim. So, you know, the proposed plea agreement had to do with forfeiture, and at least as I look at this, it means that his forfeiture case, you know, so that he wouldn't distance himself from anything that a forfeiture order that was directed at him. didn't have anything to do with all the other players in terms of forfeiture. But, of course, that's not real clear in here, whether it's just his, because it doesn't say, it says ancillary stages of any forfeiture proceeding. So that could be his. It could be the co-defendants.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that lack of clarity, or perhaps combined with his educational level, just further demonstrates in this case why it was important for counsel to effectively explain the terms of the plea agreement to Mr. Estramera, when instead all he did was continue to insist that Mr. Estramera would have to cooperate with his co-defendants and others by providing information and testimony against them. And regardless of what he read the plea agreement as stating, it was counsel's continued insistence that he would, in fact, have to cooperate, which was constitutionally deficient advice that led him to plead guilty. And this constitutionally deficient advice occurred throughout Mr. Estramera's case, and it cannot be explained away as being strategic or made in good faith under the facts of this case. And the district court then further erred in denying his claim without an evidentiary hearing by holding that Mr. Estramera could not establish prejudice because it was not likely he accepted the plea. Rather, the circumstances throughout his case show that he wanted to accept responsibility for his actions. He told the police after he was read his rights that he wanted to accept responsibility, and he told the district court on an earlier occasion that he wanted to take responsibility and that he was not going to trial. And these circumstances support his affidavit testimony that the only reason he did not accept the plea agreement was because of counsel's constitutionally deficient advice that he would have to cooperate with the government by providing information and testimony against his co-defendants and others. And that's why he did not enter the plea.
Is there any indication, I take it not, but is there any indication that his motive, there are two possible motives for his not wanting to cooperate against the co-defendants or other, you know, drug people? One would be that he was afraid of being rubbed out by the gang. The other would be just sort of honor among thieves. So is there any indication which of these were his motive? Or both?
No, Your Honor.
There's
nothing in the limited record on appeal without the evidentiary hearing to suggest why he was unwilling to cooperate, just that he was unwilling to testify against his co-defendants and others. And with that, I would like to move to the statutory tolling of Mr. Estramera's claim. Mr. Estramera argued that he was entitled to statutory tolling.
Is there anything
tolling
in the record about what the law library to which he would have had access contains?
The government presented an affidavit by Lori Cunningham, the supervisory attorney, and I cannot recall at this point if it went into the specific materials that the library had. It stated that they had a physical library that they were phasing away for an electronic library, but I'm not sure it went into the contents. I would have to check on that, Your Honor.
And did the affidavit say how often an inmate could get into that library?
The affidavit said that they could make a request. It didn't say under what circumstances those requests were granted.
And how often they were granted.
Or how often they were granted.
Or weekly, or how much time you could spend there. And that wasn't specified, was it?
I believe that the time in the physical library was specified, but not the electronic
access. And what was the physical time?
I would have to double-check that, Your Honor. I'm
not sure. What's an electronic library?
The affidavit does not explain what the electronic library would be, but I assume it's materials made available through a computer terminal.
Well, would that mean he'd have a terminal in his cell, or would he go to some place and there'd be a terminal? And would someone explain how you search online or search wherever the materials are stored?
Your Honor, I believe that is a perfect example of why the district court held that on this limited factual record, the question of access could not be determined because there's simply not enough about why he was denied access, what that access would have been, whether the access would have been adequate. That's not in the record.
And did the defense request that some of these questions that we have be answered by the government?
He did request an evidentiary hearing, and also the on his petition mm-hmm. and tolling if necessary, and the district court denied his claims
right.
without the evidentiary hearing.
I just wondered if, you know, specifics like some of the questions we're asking were part of that request for the hearing. You just assumed that that would have come out in the hearing.
I believe his request for the hearing was, his focus was particularly on the merits rather than the statutory tolling. But I believe that these are all questions that would, you know, be presented in an evidentiary hearing and properly resolved in that posture.
You're in your rebuttal
yeah.
time.
Unless the court has any further questions, I would reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Ms. Flora. Mr. Bindi.
Good morning. May it please the court. The motion should have been dismissed as untimely. It was filed more than 7 months past the limitations, the one-year limitations period. The equitable tolling argument made below has been abandoned on appeal, and statutory tolling is the only thing that's left here. The access to or adequacy of a law library is not a settled question in this district, although there is case law that suggests that it's not illegal for or unconstitutional for inmates to lack access to a law library.
But, of course, the district court didn't have any of the particulars on what the access was, what the electronic library meant. All these questions that we have, the district court had no clue and basically punted the ball and went to the merits.
All of that
you know,
is true.
To say, you know, yes, you've each provided all these various things, and, you know, so I'm not going to rule because I have so many different things before me. I'm just going to go to the merits. None of these questions were resolved.
That's true.
So your reference to constitutionality is way, way out in left field. That's not the question. The question is not whether there's a constitutional requirement for a law library. The question is, if the person doesn't have access to a library, does that mean that he should get more time, either under equitable tolling or under the, you know, the impediment provision of the statute?
Well, the statute says that
you can have an impediment
the time
that's not unconstitutional, right?
You can. However,
if he needs the law library, it's not provided to him, you can't hold him to the deadline.
Well, but the statute says an impediment imposed by the government.
Come on, this is a terrible argument.
All right. Then I'll move on to the next
argument.
And
on the merits, look, I'm picking up on something that Judge Williams said that I hadn't sufficiently appreciated. This paragraph 15 about forfeiture in the second plea agreement, it's clearly about the forfeiture of his own property.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Mm-hmm. Well, what does that have to do with his honor among thieves argument, right? It's his own property. He's just saying, look, you got property. The first sentence says, if property is going to be, can be seized. And the third sentence says that giving up your property doesn't mean that property is a credit against anything you owe the government, right? Fine, or anything like that. And the middle sentence is this mysterious one about the ancillary stages of any forfeiture proceeding. But in context, since it's in between these other two sentences, it's about forfeiting his property. It's not about him somehow becoming involved in a forfeiture proceeding against another drug guy in which he's asked to say, well, isn't it true that is, you know, proceeds of drug money, of drugs or...
I agree. It's about forfeiture.
And we don't know anything about what the educational background or, you know, of this intelligence and so on of the defendant is, and we don't know anything about what the lawyer told him.
No, we know none of that because there was no hearing.
Mm-hmm. So
isn't that a terrible vacuum? of relevant fact?
What is
more irresponsible? I mean, supposing from the transcript it sounds as if this fellow is not terribly, you know, he's not well educated. You give him this 10-page thing, and the lawyer just gives it to him and says, "Read this." You can't understand. You can't understand at all. Particularly, couldn't understand your interpretation of paragraph 15.
Well, we don't know what the lawyer would say about the advice that he provided.
Well, why not have a hearing so the lawyer can, if he remembers, explain whether he did anything besides give him the agreement to read.
The cooperation issue.
Is that typical for defense lawyers? They give the proposed plea agreement to the defendant and say, "Read this," and tell me whether you want to sign it. Right?
I wouldn't think that's typical, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Would you think it professional?
No. Mm-hmm.
Well, if the lawyer acted unprofessionally, and shouldn't that bear on his right to at least a hearing?
The defendant was not prejudiced by any shortcomings of his lawyer because he wasn't going to plead guilty.
That's not at all clear, because if the lawyer explained to him, "Look, you don't have to implicate anybody else. All this paragraph is about is your property being forfeitable to the government. It had nothing to do with anybody else's property."
What Estramera told the district court when he asked for new counsel was that he was unhappy with the advice he was getting regarding the potential sentence. He said, "I think I'm at level 34, maybe level 32. My lawyer is telling me I'm at 38. I think I'm in criminal history category 4. My lawyer is telling me I'm in 6. I think that 15 years that the lead guy in this case got is a cap on my sentence. I should not get more than that."
Mr. Bindi, I could understand on the basis of your argument a district court, after a hearing, making a finding of fact that there was no prejudice because Estramera would not have pleaded guilty. But without a hearing and a finding of fact, you're here in the Court of Appeals. We can't make factual findings on our own. Right? Estramera says there's also evidence in the record that he wanted to plead guilty. So it looks like we've got a conflict. Maybe a conflict between statements that Estramera himself made.
We're not disputing that he had an interest in pleading guilty. We're just saying that he himself told the district court that the reason he's not pleading...
Yeah, but as I say, that might be a basis on which the district court could make a finding of fact. But there are no findings of fact in this record.
That's true.
In addition, the district court, he clearly was having some conflict with his lawyer. When he looked at his calculation, the lawyer looked at his calculation, and the district court didn't appoint another counsel for him.
That's true.
And had that option, that was within the discretion of the district court, because it seems to me it had almost gotten into a failure to communicate or a breakdown. Now, of course, we had a defendant here who was pretty savvy when you look at what his criminal history is. I mean, he's got plenty of convictions, putting him in a 6 category. But it seems that they were on the brink of, if your lawyer's telling you these are the numbers and you're saying, "No, these are the other numbers," and we are having disagreements about that, that has something to do with the fundamental communication between the client and the lawyer. So I know we're not here on the district court's denial of his request for new counsel, but, I mean, to me, you have to look at it in that entire context, what that statement was that was made to the district court. And as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, there's no hearing on this.
That's true. You know, but, you know, tension between lawyer and client in criminal cases is not uncommon and is not by itself
right,
a sufficient
reason.
Right,
but we have reason. Way more than that here. We have way more than their disagreement on the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would see at the time of the sentencing,
at the time of sentencing? I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know how.
I don't understand why the ages of criminal defendants are not routinely stated. It's obviously material when you're talking about the length of a sentence, right? It's a difference between getting a 30-year sentence, say, when you're 17 and when you're 60. So why don't you tell us what the age of the defendant is when he's sentenced?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't know how old he was when he was sentenced. I would, with my remaining time, like to make one more point regarding the timeliness of the motion, and that is that access to the law library was not the reason he blew over the one-year deadline. As he explained to the district court, he expected the lawyer who represented him on direct appeal to file something on his behalf, and for 11 months he tried to communicate with this lawyer without success. And then he tried to find out through the clerk's office what the status of his case was, and that's why he missed the deadline. And so for these reasons, we would ask...
Well, that sounds like a perfectly good reason for missing a deadline.
I don't agree, Your Honor. For tolling to apply...
Holland, say that that's a possible reason for missing the deadline? Possible reason for tolling?
Perhaps for equitable tolling, but that's not being argued here. Okay. Statutory tolling is the only issue. Thank you.
Anything further, Ms. Florin? Before we get going, I want to pin down what Mr. Bindi said. Are you relying on Holland against Florida and principles of equitable tolling?
Your Honor, we are explicitly relying on statutory tolling because it appears that this court
I understand that. I'm asking whether you're also relying on Holland.
No, Your Honor, because it appears that this court has foreclosed equitable tolling based on lack of access to a law library.
No.
This is a question about the lawyer. Are you relying on the argument that Estramera had a lawyer who abandoned him and that is a justification for his late filing?
Yes, Your Honor, that could be another potential avenue addressed in an evidentiary hearing on the question of tolling. But Mr. Estramera's primary argument is that he should be granted statutory tolling based on his lack of access to the law library.
Yeah, but equitable tolling is easier to show than statutory.
Right.
The statutory tolling is really equitable estoppel, right? Showing misconduct. The government erected an impediment, right? It's when a defendant prevents you from filing in time. That's equitable estoppel. When you just did the best you could, nobody's fault, you did the best you could, and you just couldn't file in time, that's equitable tolling. It's easier to show. Now, there might be an argument that the fact that this statute specifies impediment was meant to exclude equitable tolling. That's a separate question.
Yes, Your Honor. I see that I'm out of time.
But you're going to embrace equitable tolling now that you understand what it means, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes.
I think that both would be appropriate on an evidentiary hearing, which Your Honor's questions have demonstrated is necessary in this case. So I request that this court reverse and remand his case for an evidentiary
Good
hearing.
Answer.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Flora, we appreciate your willingness and that of your firm to accept the appointment in this appeal and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement.